We were doing mob programming, which means by definition, we're rotating who's driving at any given point in time. And every 2 to 3 minutes, we were switching who was driving. And then the rest of the developers in the room were directing us through what to build. I'd say we were about twice as productive. And it was because we had all those brilliant minds in the room.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host.
Hey, everyone. Today, we're talking with Jeff Langer, who is the founder and owner of Langer Software Solutions. Jeff's an avid extreme programming practitioner with over 40 years of experience in software. He's a contributor to two of Robert C. Martin's books, Clean Code and Clean Agile. He's the co-author of Agile in a Flash and a well-known name in the world of agile software development in general. And so in today's conversation, we're going to dig into why he sees mob programming as the most effective way to develop software, his keys to remote work success, something he's practiced for over 11 years, and overall, some hot takes on a couple of key issues in the industry today. So Jeff, we're psyched to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me in. Good to see you again, Jack.
Yeah, good to see you too, Jeff. I'd love to hear, Jeff, why do you think that mob programming is the most effective way to develop software?
Ultimately, to me, it boils down to minimizing overhead and all the little things that distract us from getting quality software delivered. When we work as solo developers, we kind of do what I would call old school agile. And you have these meetings where you have to talk about what am I doing versus what are they doing? What is this pair working on versus what is them? To make sure that we're coordinating who's going to be doing what, who's working with who today, whose toes do we need to avoid stepping on, and so on. Along with that sort of process necessarily comes in things like pull requests. So throughout the development week, we have to find time to set aside the work that we're focusing on, pick up work that someone else built, and do a little quick review on this stuff and let them continue and integrate that the software that they just built. And to me, it's like, okay, that's great, but maybe the optimal way of doing this would be, why don't you just come and sit with me and we can talk through the software that you built, rather than have this formalized online process through a web tool like GitHub. To me, it's just, again, suboptimal. Why not just get to the heart of the matter and build the software together the right way in the first place, rather than build it, toss it to somebody else, have them review it and come back with some problems, send them back to you, you fix this, you fix that, send it back to them, they review it again. To me, that is just way too much unnecessary trying to toss things over the wall. I mean, it's designed to be a streamlined process, but in reality, it's, I think, part of one of the things that's slowing us down. So if you start to get rid of all these rituals and mechanisms that take things offline, then I think you start to speed up in terms of being able to develop.
I think the biggest counterpoint to that I hear when I talk to folks about this is that, sure, maybe you don't have to do the PR review process, but the reality is having 2, 3, 4 people focused on the same unit of work means fewer units of work can happen at any given time. What's your response to that?
I've done all of this pair programming, mob programming with developers that range from novice to senior. And maybe one of the most exciting experiences I had is we had a regular weekly meeting where we built software, and we meaning just anybody in the community who wanted to join and learn more about things like test-driven development and so on. I'd say we were about twice as productive. And it was because we had all those brilliant minds in the room. While I was driving and someone else was directing me through, here's what we should be working on next, someone else was sitting there and kind of thinking about, chewing on, okay, that's great, but we also need to make sure we're considering this. We weren't slowing down for all the things that typically slow us down. You've got, you know, immediate solutions at your disposal. Because everybody in the team has been working on the same code base, most everybody in the team is familiar with all the dusty corners and all the not-so-dusty corners of the code base. So you have all the knowledge you need about whatever it is you need to make decisions around. When it comes to technical challenges, the odds of basically figuring out how to solve something more quickly increase. And I think that's really what this is all about. You can look at all sorts of stuff around minimizing work in process from lean manufacturing and lean software development. And really, this is one of the primary things we're talking about is the more you reduce the work in process or WIP, the more streamlined you're going to be, the more likely you're going to get into a development flow and deliver things sooner than later. I used to show a chart, this is Agile, right? Typical Agile is you've got, let's say, a team of five developers, and you start in an iteration or a sprint. So for 2 weeks, you're going to work on things and hopefully deliver it at the end of 2 weeks. The classic thing I saw virtually everywhere I went was five developers and five different stories in play at once. And so now you have all this, if you want to use lean terminology, all this inventory sitting around in terms of code that people are building. Ultimately, that becomes one of the biggest problems is you're trying to manage way too many things at once. And ultimately, all that inventory or code has to integrate into a singular code base. And that's where the problems begin. And not only that, you've got five individuals with five different ideas about those five facets of features we need, going to go in slightly different directions about how we should best solve those problems. So ultimately, what that leads to is a code base that's kind of a mess, to put it nicely.
What are the things that typically slow down software development most that you think mob programming addresses?
First off, it's a wonderful tool for not having to say the same thing to a bunch of people multiple times. So I started using it in classrooms, and as I did, I started just kind of collecting all these notions about why I think we go faster because we are mob programming. I already mentioned the rituals. There's a lot of overhead in typical as practice Agile, and honestly, most of that stuff's not really Agile by definition. It's just things that people landed on. All the knowledge is there. We don't have to go find people to help us with the answers. All the wisdom is there. So you've got collected experience about how to solve problems. It's something we do all day long, and I think we discount it a lot. In my typical development day, I've been building software for 40 years, and I still hit these stupid things. It's like, okay, why isn't this working? And I'll spend a half hour to 2 hours digging down why I did this. This worked fine 6 months ago. Now it's not working. I'm doing something stupid. So it's really nice to have all the backup there to help you more quickly find those answers that you should probably know. Everybody understands the code. We don't have to spend as much time analyzing what's already in the system. I need to know how it works to know where my changes are going to go. So our focus is, let's just help everybody get ramped up on this code base at the same time. You're going to get more consistent solutions. You might have five developers doing five separate stories. And, this is part of the reviews are supposed to help with is we want to make sure that before we integrate it with the rest of the code base, it looks the same, it follows our same standards, and we're all happy with the design. So here, when you take mob programming, where we're actively working together, that is an active form of review, and it basically prevents anything from going in the source base that anybody on the team would be unhappy with. If there's a debate, we work through it quickly and make a decision enough to move forward. We don't typically bog down in those things, but at least we're not having one person produce code, reviewing it, and then realizing, well, this is a mess and this is going to have to be rewritten. Or we're going to put it in the software, which is more typically what happens. And now we're dealing with this crummy code for the rest of the lifetime of the software. So I think they're all intangibles. It's really hard to sit down and pin down why these things slow us down. But once you start getting this list of how many little things there are that we do that cost us time and money, low quality software for the most part, it really adds up over time.
When do you see mobbing as a bad choice?
So I will say, first off, it's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. There are folks out there that have a really hard time working in this sort of environment constantly. And it's fairly rare. But I've really seen very few teams that for whom the mob programming was a bad idea. One of the bigger challenges to mob programming is this external notion that you're not going fast enough, and it's probably because of the mob programming. To which I respond, where's the proof in that? I've seen far too many systems to know that one of our biggest problems is just system quality. Over time, it degrades. It's harder to work with. It's slower to make changes. It's riskier to make changes, which leads to more defective stuff going out, which increases our costs and so on. So to me, it's this whole quality aspect. What we are ultimately looking for is the ability to make changes without any additional costs incurred because of the difficulty of getting new code in the system.
You did tell me before we hopped on this recording that you no longer have much nice to say about pair programming, despite having promoted it for a long time. I'm curious what changed.
I encountered pair programming in 2000. I read Kent Beck's XP book and thought, well, that's a really weird idea that I'm going to be essentially married for the day with another developer. And then I took a job with Object Mentor, so 2000. And my first job was to go out and start teaching XP to folk. And one of the things in extreme programming is pair programming. And I thought, wow, this is really not something I want to do all day. But I learned how to do it effectively and actually learned to enjoy pair programming quite a bit. Sitting with people that were interested in doing better, that were just excited about building software like I've always been, I really enjoyed that. After I left Object Mentor, I went on to form my own thing. There was an extreme programming team. I was on the team with 17 folk, which is nuts. We all sat around one giant table in the middle of the room and we pair programmed all day. It was 10, 11-hour days, and we paired for pretty much all those 10, 11 hours, which is also nuts. Don't do that. I learned a lot of it. I actually really enjoyed the experience, but I also started to notice challenges. And then over the years, as I started to work with customers more, I would actually come up with things that just rubbed me the wrong way. You're working one-to-one intimately with another individual, and that's great. But I found, personally, I can only do that for so long. I need my space. I need to be able to back out mentally and physically from this relationship. I learned very quickly that maybe pair marriage is a really bad idea. And unfortunately, this is how pair programming is practiced in so many places. I've been in enough cases where I've been paired with someone who, for whom I'd rather not spend any more than, let's say, 15 minutes. It is an intimate relationship. You have to understand how to work with each and every other member of your team in a one-on-one basis. And most of those are probably going to be fine. I can socially get along with anybody, but there are going to be people that drive you nuts. So I learned that, you know, to be effective, you do need to make sure you are rotating your pairs from time to time because it's a better way of reviewing things. And I found that's kind of a wonderful little rule that I've tried to institute here and there, which is make sure you have at least three sets of eyes on any story that you want to put into production before you finish it. So, you know, there's no end of little challenges. You've got people with personality difficulties. That can be challenging.
Well, go ahead. If I can interrupt you on this to challenge you, nothing you just said about pairing doesn't seem to be the case also and for mobbing?
Yes. Yeah, so as mentioned, it's a one-on-one intimate relationship. You and I are going to be working together all day long without respite, but I'm stuck with you for the next 3 days. Maybe I'm in an obnoxious mood, and after maybe a few hours, you probably think, I need to go do something else, or this is really going to start being a frustrating workday. With the mob programming, it's a different dynamic. It is a group dynamic, and yes, you have everybody in that room, but one of the cool things about that, if you've got four or five people in your mob, is you can check out physically and or mentally. So I can decide, you know what, I need a breather. My brain's not functioning fully right now. Let me get up, walk outside, go do something else. Or you might want to do that to help solve a problem that the team's maybe focusing on, and you think the best way to do it for you is to get out of that room and think a little bit on your own. The nice thing about the mob is it keeps going, so we can keep working if there's drops from 5 to 4 to 3, so people can come and show back into the mob when they feel ready to do so. So I am not stuck with this intimate one-on-one, face-to-face relationship for multiple days. So I think that is the big difference, and I use the word intimacy because I think that truly is the challenge here. I already said 10, 11 hours is insane. But certainly the limit, I think, for most teams that I've seen to be effective is somewhere around 5 hours. And anything beyond that, I get a sense that people are just kind of tired of it toward the end of a day.
A lot of the settings that you've described have been in-person settings. Does the importance of collaborative programming change when a team is in-person versus remote?
The really cool thing about pair programming or mob programming is, first off, it engages you. during the day. You can't just nod off. You kind of have to be paying attention to be able to do it effectively. But it also engages you socially. Having this social interaction throughout the day is extremely important. I wouldn't have survived this long. I'm an introvert by nature, so I don't think I would have survived 40 years of development without social interaction throughout it. And I think had it been COVID sends us all home and we have to all just work on our own and not really talk to each other than in meetings, I don't think I would have been able to cope through these past few years doing that.
So it sounds like to you, collaborative programming, remote pair programming, remote mob programming is potentially more valuable than doing it in person. Am I hearing that right?
That's debatable. The Agile Manifesto says something about face-to-face communication being the most important, best way to convey things. And I firmly believe it. It doesn't mean your faces can't be on camera, but I still think there are some concessions. It is harder to get people to react appropriately if you're not there to see body language and, you know, understand where they're coming from and so on. So I think that you lose some of that aspect. But otherwise, from a tooling stance, it's great. You just walk. I walk into my office from my bedroom and sit down, and every tool is at my disposal. Everybody else has the same kind of setup as me, so nobody is disadvantaged in terms of what their setup is. We found a way so that everybody can kind of use their own tools on the team, and that's kind of cool too. You know, I've worked with people with accessibility needs. Just getting around and moving into an office can be a challenge for some folks. So to ask somebody to go move from the mob room to their cube and so on can be a burden. I've worked with people with visual impairment who need special monitor setups and so on. And you can certainly accommodate that all in an office, but if you're remote, those folks can be set up and ready to go no matter what their personal challenges are.
That does feel like a huge advantage of remote work. So what's your playbook? What is your playbook or set of tools, processes? What is your recommendation for how to work remotely effectively?
I have talked a lot about my programming we have, and I really actually haven't mentioned what I think the two rules for doing that successfully are. So first off, to answer the question, finding a way to get people to work together as opposed to pretend to, writing documents, throwing things over the wall, trying to coordinate things and so on. To me, that's not working together. The agile stuff I brought up earlier is really predicated on best idea being, let's just talk through everything. This is where Ron Jeffries comes up with the notion of let's just write an idea on a card. We'll use that as a reminder of a conversation. We're going to have that conversation throughout as we go every day throughout building software. Regardless of whether we think Agile's dead or not, that notion is the most powerful out of all of it. The heart of this is to get directly to the heart of the matter by talking to each other and talking through our challenges and understandings of what it is we think we need to build. So if we're expected to review code, there's lots of ways to do it. You can try to throw things over the wall with pull requests. But I think if you distill it to the simplest possible scenario, it is get everybody in a room and have them working throughout the day and continuing to communicate through the problems we're trying to solve. This is, again, where I think mob programming plays really well. You can do that also in a way that's not terribly effective, just like anything, just like pair programming and pair marriages. So I do insist on a couple simple rules if we're going to employ mob programming within a team. I've mentioned the roles driver and navigator, but I really didn't define them terribly well. When we mob, one person has control of the keyboard, and so therefore the focus of everybody else is on what they're typing in and what's showing up on the screen. So that person is our driver. And then we have a bunch of other folks, the rest of the folks on the teams, we call navigators. The navigator's job is to direct the person at the keyboard through what we want them to do next in terms of getting software into the system. Llewellyn Falco calls this strong style pairing. And I think the quote that he has is, for an idea to get into the computer, it's got to go through someone else's hands. So I'm going to talk the driver through where we're going. The driver is listening. Their job is not to make decisions. You're listening to the direction we're giving you, and you are translating that direction into appropriate code. You might not even be very good at that at the outset. You might not even be a programmer. I've worked in mobs where we've had some managers who had coded Last in 1987 sit and actually drive and do so reasonably effectively. With more seasoned folks or with people that have been on the team for a while, their ability to interpret what we're asking them to do starts to ramp up pretty rapidly. So I might start by saying, you need to write this code. And a less experienced person might say, well, what do I need to do? What are the actual letters and words that I have to type? A more experienced developer is going to be able to very quickly translate that. We need a test that verifies what happens if we delete a customer when they haven't paid their invoice, whatever. Here's a simple scenario. Oh, okay, I know what that means. So it starts to become a higher level conversation, and the people driving start to get the picture very quickly. So the communication becomes simpler. So that's the driver navigator role. As far as the two rules, it's probably important that we don't make somebody be the driver all day long. So one of the most important rules is that we rotate who is the driver. They're going to sit in that chair for a while and translate our direction into code again. They might, while they're driving, come up with a better idea. It's like, okay, you guys are telling me to do this, but here's a better way we can approach solving this problem. That's great, but you're driving. So the rule is you have to get up, relinquish your seat, become a navigator, and let someone else become the driver. So this means that, you had a great idea. You're going to have to talk us through that great idea rather than run away, be what Tim Ottinger calls a runaway driver, and decide where I'm going to go in this direction. A team left to their own devices, they read about mob programming, they go in a room and decide they want to do this collaborative thing with everybody on the team in the same room, is most likely to devolve into team lead does all the driving. So the person with the most experience on the team grabs a keyboard and they're making all the decisions, and the rest of the team is left to just sit and watch. You might call this worker-rester pattern, I think, as a name he came up for this. One person does all the work, the other one rests and falls. I literally will fall asleep in that circumstance. So ultimately, we want to make sure that we don't have people dominating the session. Therefore, we insist that that role rotate. Got a great idea? You want to tell us about it? Get out of the driver's seat. Otherwise, the rotation occurs on a fairly frequent basis, which is the second rule. Second rule is that the rotation periods are short. So if I tell people short, they'll devolve to probably half hour, 3 hours in the driver's seat. Way too long.
Yeah.
So we're typically rotating. My standard to start with is like 5 minutes. If you're not fully versed in your tools, you've got some novice folk in the mix, it will certainly adjust to the circumstance. But what we are seeking is, let's get something important done in 5 minutes, and then you can hand the keyboard to the next person to drive. You can put a timer on things. The tool I use will beep at you and say, all right, somebody else's turn to be driving at this point. But the idea is also to help us start focusing in tiny increments, which is maybe one of the best ways to approach software development overall. So if you've done test-driven development, that's really cool. You can write a test in 5 minutes and then maybe hand the keyboard over to the next person. They can get it to pass in 5 minutes. They can hand it to the next person, and they can do some cleanup on the code to make sure that it's something we want to push into production across the next 5 minutes. So these are very, very short cycles.
I've heard Llewellyn also talk about the need in a mob to make sure that you don't go too long between driving sessions. Because if you have four people, for example, and you're switching every 30 minutes, you're not in the driver's seat for 2 hours, which makes it extremely easy to fall asleep or to have that worker rester pattern simply because it's too long. And so the bigger the group is typically a driver for smaller rotations. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the word I use is engagement. And I'm a perfect example of someone who will disengage if I'm sitting there watching someone and not really very active in the discussion on it. So the nice thing about the 5 minute rotations, or 3 minutes or 2 minutes as we've even tried, is that engagement's pretty darn high. If you know you're going to be moving into that driver's seat shortly too, you're absolutely wanting to make sure you pay attention enough such that you can get in the driver's seat and not be fumbling around for several minutes. So engagement is very important. So other things crop up as well. One of those is fear. One of the more interesting experiences I had was helping set up a dojo at a company about 7 years ago. And there was one person in the room, and she just thought the idea was terrible to do this mob programming thing. So we talked with her a little bit on the side, and we just wanted to make sure we understood where she was coming from. And she explained she's pretty nervous about the whole idea. She didn't want to be coding in front of everybody else. So there's absolutely an aspect of fear. We don't want to expose maybe also that we don't quite know everything we should know. I still have that fear. Like, oh gosh, what if somebody realizes I don't know this little technology as intimately as I probably should where I'm at in my career?
Both are very vulnerable experiences.
Oh, yeah. We fully understood. We said, look, you know what? We're going to make sure you're only in the seat for a few minutes. And she's like, yeah, I guess so. And I said, well, just keep talking with you every day for the next week or two and just see how you feel. By the end of the next week, she's like, I really love this. And she was starting to champion it to other folks across the organization. I thought it was really cool to see that.
Jeff, before I let you go, you touched on it very briefly, and I know it's a contentious topic right now, so I wanted to get your take. How do you feel about this big return to office push that you're seeing companies make these days?
I know where it's coming from. I think there's two primary drivers for why RTO is a thing. First is economic, and it's really hard to deny the fact that, you know, COVID impacted quite a few cities quite dramatically. My daughter lives in Seattle. She described to me basically, you know, downtown and Pioneer Square areas were hit pretty hard by the fact that people were no longer working there. Restaurants and whatnot saw their clientele disappear overnight. There were no end of places that shuttered during COVID. And certainly you had then mayors basically saying, no, you need to stay downtown and keep your people downtown. So there are economic pressures, and I get it. My take on that is now we need to learn to adapt as a society to more and more work from home. I have my own selfish ones. I mean, the typical list is simple one is the environment. We claim to care about global warming and such, and yet you say electric cars are great, but they still have some impact on the environment. Let's find ways to not have excuses to drive to a place unnecessarily and have that kind of an impact on the world around us. From a more selfish reason, I don't want to get in a car and drive for 20 minutes. Deal with traffic. Every city I know of, it's got traffic problems, and it's not a fun commute. So by the time I get to work, I've already introduced some level of my stress into my day that I really don't need. And then I get to do the same thing going home. It just seems ridiculous to me if we have a way to work effectively. Which leads me to the other thought in this, which is we do have other ways to work effectively. For the past 5 years, I found that we can build software in a highly effective manner and still enjoy it and get the social gratification that we need. It's not quite the same as being there, but it's pretty darn close. It just gives us more time with family as well as more time to relax at the end of the workday. So I think it's wonderful for that. I see no reason to force it. And I have to make the conclusion that a lot of companies are doing this not just for the economic impact reasons, but for the fact that they couldn't figure out on their own how to make it effective. So to me, it's a failure on their part. And I don't think it's fair to basically punish all the folks who did figure out how to make it work effectively and how to actually produce in some cases more effectively than, you know, coming into the office.
Well, with that, Jeff, I just want to say thank you for being generous with your time and perspective. If folks want to learn more about you and your work, where should they go?
Yeah, go off to my site, langersoft.com. And, you know, I haven't been as active on it lately. I'm trying to start a new series of articles around AI and test-driven development and whatnot. So you'll see some of that show up there, but there are probably a couple hundred blog posts, couple hundred pointers to articles and pointers to things like Quora, where I've answered like 1,000 questions. So I just love to talk about this stuff and write about it. So you'll see lots of perhaps useful things if you start digging through there.
Very nice. Well, we'll link to that in the show notes. Thank you again, Jeff, for making the time, being generous with that time of perspective. We really appreciate it. Hope to chat with you again soon.
Thanks, Jack. Appreciated the time to talk. Hope I didn't speak too fast, and appreciate it. Have a good evening.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @Tupelonx or visit distributed.fm.